This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik. We're doing our public health show today and we're looking at the recent announcement by Minister of Health, Dato' Sri Dr. Zulkifli Ahmad, who said that the government is looking at policy changes towards the decriminalisation of drug use. So we have in the studio with us Azrul Mohamad Khaleb, CEO of Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy, our co-host today, together with Professor Dato' Dr. Adiba Binti Kamaruzaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine, University of Malaya, and Associate Professor Dr. Ruzdi Abdul Rashid, Consultant Psychiatrist, also from University of Malaya. And we'll be discussing what would be a rational approach to dealing with the drug use problem, what are the merits of decriminalisation, and I think what we can learn from the harm reduction experience here in Malaysia. Good afternoon, everyone. How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Prof. Adiba, I just it struck me that you were on BFM almost a year ago, in June last year, actually, in conjunction with the Global Support Don't Punish campaign. You were talking exactly about this.
I was.
My memory fails me.
Did you think that quite so soon we'd be sitting down and looking at a landscape where quite possibly decriminalisation will be a reality?
No, I must say, Shao-Ik, it was a very pleasant surprise to see the joint announcement by the two ministers. Very powerful announcement by the Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin, the Minister of Home Affairs, and Dato' Sri Dr. Zulkifli, Minister of Health. Yes, we have been working hard to come to this point, but you're right. I think it did take us all by surprise somewhat, but a very pleasant surprise.
And what about you, Dr. Ruzdi? Your initial reaction to this?
Yeah, I'm actually very, very happy. We don't expect, actually, we already heard these two big men announce about decriminalization of drug users. We have been waiting for this for many, many years, in fact.
Okay, so perhaps to get an understanding of what we're talking about when we are referring to drug use in Malaysia, what is the extent of the drug problem here?
Okay, I think it's important to put it in the global perspective, yeah? Every year, the United Nations Office for Drugs and Crime puts out what's called the World Drug Report and puts out estimates of the extent of the drug problem globally. In the 2019 report, it states the estimates for 2017, because there's always a lag. It was estimated that there were 271 million people, or that's 5.5% of the global population aged between 15 to 64, have used drugs in the previous year. So that's a huge proportion number of people. But out of that, 35 million can be classified as having problematic drug use or substance use disorder. So the numbers are big, and we need to put it in perspective. And of those, only 1 in 7 have access to treatment. Turning to Malaysia, we don't have a good comprehensive grip of the numbers of people who use drugs. Firstly, because, you know, our definition of drug use is not very clear here in Malaysia when it comes to the statistics. So what we have is actually numbers based on arrests. And arrests can be people who are using it for the first time, recreational drug use, wrong place, wrong time, or can be people with substance use disorders or addicts who have been arrested repeatedly. So if I can quote the figures from ADK, in 2017, those who were arrested under the Akta Dadah Berbahaya 1952 was 158,000 thereabouts. And for positive urine, arrested by police, 208,000. And under Penyalahgunaan Dadah Section 15, 80,000. So, you know, these numbers, some may be repeated arrests, some may have fallen into the same category, but safe to say, probably around 100 to 200,000 are on the books, yeah.
And Prof, when you say the way that data is collected in Malaysia does not differentiate between first-time user or much more hardcore, mm-hmm. or even the kind of drugs necessarily. Mm-hmm. These numbers that you've been quoting, does that include people who take marijuana, recreational drugs, all the way up to cocaine?
Correct. I think there is a much more detailed breakdown in terms of types of drug use. But whether you have been caught for using marijuana for the first time or you're a repeated user, that gets all lumped into these figures.
And this is what the existing law considers a crime.
Correct.
Where you are liable to be arrested and then charged. But public health professionals, specialists such as yourselves, look at drug use as a public health issue.
As a medical issue.
Mm, so, yeah. And social issue. So mm-hmm. it's obviously covering different aspects of a problem that's more than just a legal issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So why is it a medical issue?
Well, first of all, if we go back one step, what are the risks for people to use drugs, right? So there are many risk factors, peer pressure being one of them. But there's also a significant number of people who use drugs because of, mental illness such as depression. And then added to that, there may be some genetic basis. And on top of that, there are all the social determinants for drug use, such as poverty, family breakdown. So there are all those medical as well as social risk factors. So that then puts it into a medical category. And secondly, we know that addiction, and Roshdi is the specialist in this, does things to your brain, depending on what substance you're using. It will alter the brain receptors. For instance, if you're using heroin, and if you repeatedly use heroin, it will alter the opioid receptors in the brain. And no matter how you try, the damaged receptor is in need of treatment. And that's why you get the cravings. That's why it's not going to be necessarily easily corrected by cold turkey or what have you. So there is a biological basis for treatment such as methadone, buprenorphine, etc.
I mean, that's been the approach thus far. It's in the past, you would have people going cold turkey, incarcerate them, and hopefully by 2 years they come out clean.
Mm-hmm. The alterations in the brain receptors, whether it's dopamine receptors or opioid receptors, whatever, it's not just with heroin addiction. Mm-hmm. People who have gambling addiction, people who have phone addictions, with sophisticated brain imaging studies, you can actually see the differences in people who have the disease addiction of all kinds versus people who don't.
Because this comes to a very good point here, is that why are we treating drug addiction differently? You have coffee addiction, you have chocolate addiction even.
Alcohol
addiction, tobacco addiction, and so forth. So what makes the drugs that we're talking about today, this afternoon, any different than any of these other addictions? I mean, why are we looking at it as a mental issue?
Okay, drug is a chronic relapsing brain disease. After being consuming for years and years, it alters the brain's receptors and cause damage to the what we call reward center. So this damage of the reward center is permanent. And it's actually irreversible. That is why it needs medication in order to correct it. Alhamdulillah, for addiction to opiates, drugs like heroin, morphine, we already have a list of medication that we can use. For example, like for opiates, we have methadone, we have buprenorphine, we have naltrexone. Now we have naltrexone implant even, But still, we have some challenges ahead. For the amphetamine type stimulant, we still don't have. We only rely on counseling at the moment. So that is why we need a lot of research to be done, to address issues with the amphetamine type stimulant, which now has become a major issue in our country. We need to have medications, not only to treat the complication like psychosis and also negative consequences as a result of this amphetamine type stimulant, but we need to also find solution for anti-craving. Similarly, like methadone for the opioid dependence. I think this is our urgent needs at the moment.
Going back to your question as to why, you know, drugs like heroin and all that are criminalized, whereas alcohol isn't. But for many, many years, alcohol, yeah. you know, was also had the prohibition yeah. approach and created similar kinds of societal kind of chaos and damage. The history behind the war on drugs, I think, relates back to the US around Nixon. Actually, it goes back to Nixon around the Vietnam War when many soldiers were using drugs. But also there was a background of some degree of racism, in fact, in terms of putting away African-Americans in prison. And to cut a very long story short, the intensity in the war on drugs came around the 70s, originated from the US with a tinge of racism in it. And in fact, the US has incarcerated loads and loads of people for drug use, and often there is a racial bias to it. And I think there is, in the last few years, efforts to address that. And then you have to go back to all the conventions, the drug conventions, that, again, dates back to the 60s, the Single Drug Convention that the UNODC practices. And in simplified terms, I think that was to, in a way, regulate and give guidelines to countries on how to deal with these so-called illicit drugs. But, you know, there's been all kinds of different interpretation of these drug conventions and leading to what we have now.
We'll go for a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be able to delve more into what are the issues when drug use is criminalized, what kind of impact are we seeing on the system as well as on individual mm-hmm. Users. I'm speaking to Prof. Dr. Adiba Binti Kamaruzaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine, University of Malaya, Associate Professor Dr. Rusdi Abdul Rashid, Consultant Psychiatrist also from University of Malaya, and of course my co-host Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Shao-Eek with my co-host for the Public Health Show today, Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. In the studio with us today as well, Professor Datuk Dr. Adiba Binti Kamaruzaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine with University of Malaya, and her colleague, Associate Professor Dr. Rusdi Abdul Rashid, Consultant Psychiatrist, also from UM. We are talking about decriminalisation of drug use following the announcement by the Health Minister and the Minister of Home Affairs recently. And before the break, we were looking at why are we looking at drug use as a criminal offence? You know, alcohol addiction, other forms of addiction are not treated in a similar manner. And if we're talking about a move towards decriminalisation, from society's perspective, why does it affect the rest of us who may not be touched by drug use?
Firstly, I think the cost of decriminalization, the financial cost is enormous. I mean, the financial cost of criminalization, is enormous. If you look at the cost to the police, to the courts, the prison system, you know, at each step of the way, the financial cost is enormous, right? Secondly, of course, the cost to the individual. You know, they lose their jobs. And remember, if you have a criminal record for drug use, you lose your job forever. And that then impacts on their family, immediate and extended family. Often, you know, they're males and could be the sole breadwinner. And so in the end, and many of the people who use drugs are in that 15 to 50-year-old age group, you know, the most productive members of society. If you lock them away forever, you lose that person's productivity. So it may not impact us as individuals in a direct manner, but I think in a bigger picture kind of way, it impacts us hugely.
You know, there was a report just, I think, 2 weeks ago talking about the financial costs, which you just mentioned. I think around 600 million ringgit a year being spent on addressing the issue of drug use. But we haven't really heard the benefits of decriminalization in terms of the financial cost. I mean, how much, how much savings can we get from the taxpayer's perspective? Will it mean that there'll be more people who have a drug problem who will be on the streets? Are there concerns from the public that would mean, you know, there'd be more crime, petty theft, for example, as a result of more drug users on the streets? What kind of arguments are there with regards to talking about the benefits of decriminalisation?
Let me talk about the financial costs alone first. Our colleague, Professor Vigna from the Centre of Study on Drug Addiction at USM, has done some very nice calculation of the costs of managing so-called drug use and addiction in different jurisdictions. So for what he calculated for 2015, there were 31,000 prisoners or offenders who were incarcerated purely for drug use, where that annual cost per offender was estimated to be 21,000 ringgit. So you multiply that by 31,000 people, that's 643 million. In Pusat Serenti, or otherwise known as PUSPEN, in 2015, there were 5,700 offenders, and the annual cost for Pusat Serenti is actually higher. It's 38,530 ringgit per person. That annual costs came up to 221 million for 5,800 offenders. Whereas treatment for opioid addiction and the cost of methadone has gone down tremendously compared to when we first started in 2006. In 2015, there were 37,555 people receiving treatment in the public sector. And the annual cost per person is 6,560 ringgit. In other words, it costs nearly 3.5 times more, obviously, to lock someone away in prison for drug use. And so the annual cost is 246 million. So I can go on and on and on in terms of the financial costs.
That sounds remarkable. I mean, if you were to combine PUSPEN and incarceration in prison, that's 800 million or so.
Yeah, versus 250 million.
And that certainly is an argument that should be made to our policymakers to buy into this process. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, imagine we're paying 800 million to lock someone up rather than treat them.
Correct. So secondly, in terms of the fear that, you know, the country is going to be, you know, scattered with people who use drugs, remember that not all drug users need treatment. Right. You know, there are people who are just using it for, you know, a weekend or, you know, partying or whatever. And then those who are in serious need of treatment. And then there are those in between. The idea of decriminalization is either someone comes voluntarily because they are worried about their drug use, problematic or otherwise, or their families or friends or whatever, bring them in voluntarily. And they will be then channeled to experts like Roshdi and colleagues and counsellors and be managed in with either counselling or, you know, with ATSUs, cognitive behavioural therapy, or in the case of of heroin, methadone and whatever. Instead of being locked away for cold turkey, a year in prison, come out, within 2 weeks, they relapse. So that's the whole idea, that we're not going to, I mean, the proposal is not saying that, you know, don't put them in prison, they're free to roam the streets. Not that at all, that they should be channeled into proper treatment and job skilling and, you know, counselling, etc.
So what I'd like to understand now, right now, under existing laws, where does the aspect of treatment come in at all, Dr. Roshdi?
We in clinical services, we only give treatment for those who, I mean, medical treatment for those already fall under the category of what we call substance use disorder. So for those experimenting, those who are just not yet go into what we call compulsive use, you know, they can't control their substance use. For those who are just experimenting, normally counselling is enough, you know. We not need to go In the case for opioid addiction, for example, we no need to actually start methadone. We only start methadone for those who go into chronic use, who already fulfill the criteria for opioid dependence or syndrome, or opioid use disorder, at least moderate to severe, according to the DSM-5 criteria for diagnosis. So for this group of people, we do induction as outpatient with methadone. Later on, when they achieve the maintenance dose, most of them capable of working, in fact. So if you compare with those people who've been incarcerated in drug rehab center or in prison, you have to spend money on them for food, for their shelter, for their medical health inside there. But for those who are actually receiving methadone program in the community as outpatient basis in the clinics, you know, and government health clinics, this person is actually can function. They can work, they can contribute to increase the economy of the nations.
But does that mean that the users who are or have been incarcerated don't receive treatment at all?
Yeah, they receive treatment, but unspecific treatment. It's more on lock-up than inside, force them to
not
do
evidence-based.
Matching, which is not evidence-based, as what Prof. Adiba mentioned. But in hospital, we do treatment according to evidence-based medicine. We do whole range of treatment, not only about using substance or not using substance, but we address their health issues. If they are contracted HIV, hepatitis B, TB, we actually manage that as well, you know. But in prison, we know some of these people, there is some delay in giving treatment, and they end up with the complications and even death. Some of them not even got opportunity to receive treatment at all.
Mm. So we do have a lot of laws pertaining to drug use, and one of them actually specifically is Drug Dependence Treatment and Rehabilitation Act 1983. I think the intentions were good. So like for this one, it says drug dependents can be admitted to a compulsory detention centre under Section 6, compulsory, or Section 8, voluntary. So the intention is for treatment and rehabilitation. I think the big problem is the treatment and rehabilitation activities that are carried out are not based on scientific evidence or are not medically based. That's where the problem arises. And then, of course, there are other acts and laws that actually punishes, you know, clearly punishes, for instance, for possession, and obviously the famous 39B for trafficking. So part of our advocacy is for the government to review all these laws. And to be fair, I think when these laws were written, some of them were written in the 1950s and 1970s, the knowledge that we have now around drug use is not as extensive. And
there's something very interesting about the proposal that has been shared, as much as we know, is with regards to drawing a distinction between personal use and perhaps even addiction, if you want to call it, where small amounts seem to be something that is not going to be considered a crime anymore, but larger amounts maybe would be something that you'll be looking at more of an addiction needing treatment. So when I spoke to different people, they got excited about perhaps it's not going to be a crime anymore for us to use small amounts of grass.
That's the crux of the recommendation, because people who go to prison should go to prison for violence, for committing criminal acts that does harm to other people. And so there needs to be a real distinction between using and not doing any harm to others. You may still do harm to yourself, but that's the same with alcohol, right? Versus using, and because you're using, you've broken into someone's house and whatever, that is still a criminal offence. Mm.
And this term harm, we've heard it, I think, for the past two decades, I think, when dealing with HIV.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have been talking about where's the evidence to show that decriminalisation works. And Malaysia has had a lot of experience in working on harm reduction, and you've been at the forefront of that. What lessons can be learned from before we had harm reduction in 2005 and after? I mean, what kind of evidence, because we're talking about evidence-based approaches here, right? Can we make a case okay, for decriminalization?
Sure. So let me distill this, right? For listeners who don't speak our lingo, what harm reduction is. So harm reduction is essentially an approach, a pragmatic approach, initially to reduce the harm caused by injecting drug use and drug use in general to individuals and society, specifically around the HIV epidemic. So when people who inject drugs use, you know, unsterile needles and syringes, they are at very high risk of getting HIV. So the concept of harm reduction is people will still be using drugs, but, you know, we will channel them into treatment to try and reduce their drug use, but at the same time to minimize the harm from that injecting drug use and using dirty needles and syringes, we give them clean needles and syringes. That's one component of harm reduction. And the second is the opioid substitution therapy, methadone, et cetera, et cetera. And we've been hugely successful in at least preventing HIV from this very unpopular stance by the previous government to take on harm reduction. But there was an escalation in the HIV epidemic in the early 2000s, late 90s, and we had no choice but to introduce it. We were not meeting the then MDG goals. That stated that global community wants to see a reversal of the HIV and TB, and that was the only goal that Malaysia didn't achieve at the time, and that helped the government decide on going forward with harm reduction. So what evidence have we had in terms of success? In the around the 2000 area, before the introduction of harm reduction, Ministry of Health was seeing approximately 5,000 to 6,000 new cases of HIV reported to the Ministry of Health every year. When harm reduction was introduced in 2006, we started seeing a gradual decline, and we've seen so much decline in the number of new HIV infections due to injecting drug use that in 2018, there were less than 200 people who were reported to the Ministry of Health to have had HIV from injecting drug
use.
That's remarkable. And my colleagues and I have also done a return on investment study with colleagues from University of New South Wales in terms of the return on investment on harm reduction. No doubt the government had to spend a lot of money putting in place structure for to expand opiate substitution therapy methadone within the government system and to a lesser extent the private system, and also to scale up needle exchange with Malaysian AIDS Council and our partner organisation. So spent a lot of money. But the return on investment has also been remarkable because, again, we did a study on this, and it was a modelling study looking at the number of new HIV infections. So without harm reduction, between 2006 and 2013, 2006 was when it was started, the harm reduction, we would have seen 34,220 new HIV infections, but with harm reduction, it was 21,000. So nearly 40% reduction in number of new infections. And if you project that further, by 2050, we would have avoided 134,000 new HIV infections. And in terms of dollars saved, 47 million for the first 7 years, 209 million projecting to 2023 from 2006. And if we project to 2050, nearly R1 billion in savings. Wow. Now, I always, when I do this presentation, I always joke, you know, a GLC CEO would have had, you know, mega bonuses paid if they did these kinds of savings. But alas, you know, people in public health, no such rewards. And in terms of the calculation for return on investment, it when you project it out to 2050, you definitely save more than R1 for every ringgit spent, which in health economics terms is a big return on investment.
If you wanted to capture in one sentence how this previous experience will be able to inform upon the existing proposal, what would you
say? Okay, to a certain extent, decriminalization was already practiced in Malaysia. So harm reduction was giving clean needles and syringes, but In 2011, the then Director General of ADK, Puan Sri Zuraida, she was very familiar with our efforts to expand treatment within the health setting. And she said, hey, you know, why doesn't ADK be part of this? So when she became Director General, she started transforming ADK, the Pusat Serentis Puspen, to a voluntary-based treatment centre, and also provided methadone and counselling and treatment within the Puspen. But she also expanded in many, many clinics and drop-in centres around the country. And again, we did evaluation of this, and we compared people who were in the traditional Pusat Serenti versus those who were receiving the voluntary-based treatment in the community. And in a study that was published in The Lancet, no less, and it showed that people who were in the traditional compulsory detention centres without treatment, 50% relapse within 30 days of being released. And those who were having treatment in the community on methadone-based treatment, yes, people still do relapse, because Rushdie right at the very beginning said that, you know, drug addiction is a chronic relapsing condition. 50%, you know, were still on treatment a year into treatment.
Remarkable.
So, you know, I think not only do we have local evidence for decriminalisation, and the other quick and dirty study that we did on the so-called cure and care centres that ADK had in those days, we interviewed 313 people who were attending the cure and care centres in Sungai Besi and a few other centres. 56.3% felt that it helped maintain employment. 54% were able to go back to their studies. Remember that a lot of these are adolescents who start using drugs at the age of 15. A huge proportion, 77.6%, said it improved family relations. And this is key. You know, if you want someone to recover from drug use, they need that family support and you know, societal support. So 78% out of 313 said it helped improve their family relations. 72% said they obtained permanent homes. And equally importantly, 76% said it prevented them from being arrested back to prison.
Remarkable.
Yeah, so all these studies have been published, but it just gets forgotten and drowned, and, you know, so. And finally, in terms of evidence, I think you've got global evidence. You no doubt know about the Portugal model. So Portugal was experiencing severe drug use problems back in the 2000s, just like we were, and took on this really progressive stance. And what they did was, you know, the several things. They didn't just decriminalize. So they reclassified drug users versus drug dealers and traffickers. And that's a very important
distinction,
point. Yeah. When we move forward with this, that's going to be really important. Reclassification of police quota. You know, we too have these KPIs that police have to arrest X number of people for their KPI, and that needs to be relooked. Creation of what's known as a dissuasion commission, which is a team consisting of social workers, counsellors, doctors, people from the criminal justice system. So when people come forward, they're assessed for their drug use addiction, and this dissuasion commission then says, you go for treatment, or you don't do this again, you know, you've just started using. So that's something that we can potentially. And importantly, expansion of drug treatment programs. I think, you know, a lot of people, when they think about the Portugal model, say, oh yeah, they decriminalized and that's where the success was. But actually, a key component was the expansion of treatment programs, provision of psychosocial support. And lastly, this is something that we don't do very well here in Malaysia for any program, is the extensive monitoring and evaluation that guides us to the success of otherwise of the programs. I'm proud to say that for the harm reduction program, because we knew when we implemented it, well, when we were implementing it, that we were going to get all kinds of negative comments. And one of the things that we did hand in hand with implementing the program was put in a very extensive monitoring and evaluation system, so much so that we knew, at least in the pilot project, for the first three centers where we did the needle exchange, how many needles were brought in and how many needles went out.
A quick break for now. We have in the studio with us today Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy, Prof. Datuk Dr. Adiba Kamaruzaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine, University of Malaya, and Associate Professor Dr. Rushdi Abdul Rashid, consultant psychiatrist also from the UM. We're talking about the move towards decriminalisation of drug use. When we come back from this quick break, we'll continue this conversation. So stay tuned on BFM 89.9. Welcome back on our health segment today, our public health show looking at the decriminalisation of drugs, a discussion that's been in the news a lot lately. My co-host today, Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. We're also joined by Professor Datuk Dr. Adiba Kamaruzaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine, University of Malaya, and Associate Professor Dr. Rushdi Abdul Rashid, consultant psychiatrist from University of Malaya as well, weighing in on this topic. Following up on your point, Prof. Adiba, before the break, you spoke about the expansion of treatment programs. And I'd like to turn now to Dr. Rushdi to find out more about community-based initiatives. You were key in spearheading the Ar Rahman program in the mosque here in KL. So can you share a little bit more about the importance of community initiatives like this, especially when you can work together with a religious community?
And especially getting hold of community leaders' support. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important. Mm-hmm. Prof. Adiba alluded to that just now, and the Ar Rahman model is a very good case study to have a look at.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Ar Rahman model started in, way back in year 2010. We call it a Spiritual Enhancement on Drug Addiction Rehabilitation Program, or short form SEDAR. So this program was started because at that point of time, even now actually we have limiting resources in terms of places. How to actually expand the methadone program at that point of time. Most of the existing platform, like in health sites, is already exhausted. You know? We have limited resources in terms of human resource as well as spaces. So that project was started because we want to expand the methadone program outside the existing platform. So the challenges that we face during the initial phase of starting that program is actually objection or resistance from the religious groups. They thought that methadone is something like, you know, drug replace drug, because of the term that we use, opiate substitution therapy. Yeah. But in actual fact, methadone got no effect, similarly like illicit substance like heroin. It actually got no high. If you take just alone, unless you mix with something else, then it will increase the other effect of the drug, for example, like heroin. And also the most community concerned about the safety of the mosque, because during that time, before the era of methadone, many mosques have been using as a space where they used to inject drug, especially in the toilets. You know? So they concerned about things inside the mosque disappear. They also concerned about the safety of the qariah who are coming there. Another concern when we conduct the methadone program in health or government facility at the point in time is actually lack in terms of the community participation, lack in terms of counselling input. Even though in the paper we have many type of counselling, individual, family, as well as group therapy, but it was not being implemented because of the lack of resources. So by having this community to get involved, they can actually offer something additional, so that they can actually integrate with the community early. At the same time, this community of the mosque can help them in the form of providing support, some educations. We train this mosque qariah to have some knowledge on how to actually help drug addicts, help them from preventing relapse. According to the pilot project that we have conducted, it's shown a very good and promising results. The retention rate in treatment after 1 year being on the program is almost 90%.
Really?
Yeah, wow. 88%. So that means after 1 year, you still have 88% of the participant remain in treatment, so that we can give all the intervention. We can give you know, health intervention, treat their HIV, treat their hepatitis B and C. We can also give counseling in terms of, you know, like CBT, Prof mentioned just now, and other form of psycho-spiritual treatment, which is we think that it can actually generate better outcomes. From the study that we conducted, I actually published in the Journal of, International Journal of Drug Policy, what has been shown that the quality of life is even better as compared to those persons who are receiving treatment in the hospital itself, especially in the mental well-being part.
But isn't this why, when you look at approaches like this, the issue of stigma and discrimination...
That's the key word.
You're actually trying to address, right?
Yeah, yeah.
When they're much more integrated into the community rather than just at the healthcare facility, they're much more accepting into the environment. Yeah. So in this case, is that why you picked a mosque? Yeah, and not a community hall or community clinic.
Okay, the why reason mosque? Why we start with mosque, because according to statistic at the point, even now, it's the same. Malays is the over-representative. If you look into the data from the ADK, 80%, more than 80% is actually male Muslim. So that's why we start with mosque. But the project is actually designed not only for the mosque. It's also designed to work in the
any other
religious religious setting, for example, like Christian church.
Is this why you're planning another follow-up to this particular project in Pematang Pau? I think the Member of Parliament for Pematang Pau, Nuriza, has actually indicated that...
Yeah, she's very much interested in this project because at her area, she's seen many of these people who get involved with drugs, especially this amphetamine type stimulant like pil kuda, even new psychoactive substance like kratom. They not only taking this substance, but some of these, even the methadone patients, you know, especially for those who are actually receiving low dose of methadone, they also meet with kratom, they meet with amphetamine type stimulant. So she's very concerned, and she see that the previous Araman mosque can be applied in her area. Because in Penang, in Pematang Pau, they have a quite strong foundations in terms of religion, especially in the community itself, that might be helping all these addicts, at least to prevent them from relapse early.
Yeah. It does go to show that you can counter, I mean, the resistance and objections are to be expected, but you can counter them with enough of a systematic...
It's five decades of anti-drug policies, you know, exactly. It's not... going to happen overnight, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, if you look at what's happening in the Philippines, I just read that Duterte's, you know, so-called war on drugs has made Philippines the fourth most dangerous country in the world. Mm-hmm. So
The interesting finding suffered from, the same thing.
On this mosque project, I just want to add, after 1 year we conduct the pilot project, what we found, those things in the mosque is not disappear, and even less disappear as compared to before.
Oh, you're talking about duit.
Donation
boxes and all that.
And so on, you know.
Things disappearing.
And we gain some trust from the community of the mosque after that. And that is why they want to actually increase or expand the program.
But, you know, public perception is key. Yeah. So when we're talking about decriminalization now and justice coming up, what would you say to people who feel that this decriminalization will actually encourage drug use?
I think they need to understand decriminalization is not the same as legalization of drugs. So we only save those people who actually consume drugs, and if they use small amount of drug just for themselves. But those drug pushers is actually still go into the into the current legal systems, you know. So we are not going to touch that. Even drug users who are actually doing crime, they still have to go for legal implication as well. But of course, they need to be given opportunities to be treated in the health facilities rather than, you know, straight away go to the legal system.
Yeah, so I think Rushdie hit the nail on the head, that distinction between decriminalization and legalization. I mean, they're related, but they're certainly not the same. Decriminalization is channeling someone who is using drugs but not committed any other crimes, violent crimes or harm to others, into treatment instead of what we're doing now, which is putting them within the criminal justice system, prisons, etc. Legalization is a different kettle of fish altogether.
So very quickly, if I could go around, what kind of concrete actions would you like to see taken after this announcement that would make decriminalization of drug use a reality?
Yeah, I think this is really, really important, Shai. I mean, as I said, we've been, Rushdie included, as a group of health as well as legal professionals who've been working on the background to write policy proposals to the ministers of health and to the law ministers to some extent. You know what, as Azrul said, this is decades of the way how we've managed drugs for the last 5 decades, and we want to overturn it overnight. Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen. So what needs to happen is a carefully planned, phased, even maybe feasibility pilot studies of what we mean. So within the proposal that, you know, we have put together, it's still in draft form. What I think is important is to have a very high level steering committee, task force, whatever you want to call it, consisting of different agencies, but it cannot be the usual government kind of committee. It has to be truly multi-sectoral, you know, with representatives from civil society, from people who use drugs themselves, to get, you know, input, police, everyone who's involved, mm-hmm. so that it's clear and it's consensus, built on consensus and so forth. So that's number one, I think. Number two, you know, this has to go to the Ministry of Health. There needs to be serious expansion of treatment. Ministry of Health has done a fantastic job of expanding methadone treatment, but that needs to be scaled up further for opioid addiction and incorporate people in private practice. Many, many GPs have been trained in managing addiction. So we need to, you know, make use of them, the so-called public-private partnership, smart public-private partnership. That needs to happen. And also training around ATS, because, you know, one of the criticisms towards us is that, oh, we're always talking about heroin, we're always talking about methadone. But yes, we are very aware that ATS and MPS and all these new drugs have come in. So training of healthcare professionals, of counsellors in the new, in how to manage these new drugs is equally important. So I think serious budget towards training, a structure towards training, all that needs to happen. And third thing is drug law reviews, you know, see how we can modify the laws. This is going to take time. But in terms of channeling people from, you know, whether it's voluntarily or because they've been caught by police or whatever into health, something along the lines of the Dissuasion Commission that Portugal has, we of course need to adapt it to our setting, but I think it can be done. And as I said, monitoring and evaluation of what we do, which is a distinct weakness of many of our programs in Malaysia. And with that, I think we can be confident that we can introduce this in phases. And one more, perhaps a pilot of the Portugal model, either in a state or in a district, to make sure that, you know, people know exactly what roles they have to play. And yeah, so that remains a lot of work to be done. But as I said, the Cure and Care Centre was an early model. One of the problems with the Cure and Care was that the laws and the policies were not changed. So it was done in a setting where, you know, well, to be fair, the needle exchange is still done in a setting, as you said, where the laws haven't changed. So I think the time is right for us to do this. But we have to do it properly. We have to plan, we have to budget, and we have to monitor, and we have to evaluate.
Yeah, I think we are moving towards very positive directions. We are moving from treatment of the drug problem in the institution. Now we are moving into the community, which is, I think, a lot of benefits. You know, last time when we treat patients in the institutionalization, we create sometimes more problems, especially the health problems. Drug issues is also sometimes occurs in the institutions, and it's also create a lot of troubles in terms of use of money inside and so on. Now I think we're moving towards a very good direction. I hope this suggestion by Prof. Adiba could be done, and we can actually proceed it further.
If I could say one last word, I think there is a lot of anxiety within agencies that traditionally manage people who use drugs and think that they're going to be, you know, no longer relevant and have no role in this. On the contrary, I think they have, you know, whether it's ADK or police or whoever, or Pemadam or NGOs that deal with former drug users, everyone has a major role to play in this. In the case of ADK, yeah, well, maybe we're advocating that the treatment component should move to health, but there is, as you just heard from Roshdi, you know, addiction is not just about giving pills. Addiction is about that whole psychosocial support that's needed, and that's a huge role for ADK to play. Primary prevention, you know, but no, that's for another interview.
Another show.
Another show.
I can just only echo what our two speakers have said today, but I think one of the most important things we have to realize is that consultation and the voices of the people who use drugs committee must be part of the evidence-driven approach that Prof. Adiva and Prof. Roshdi have advocated for this afternoon.
Yes, a lot of evidence there that we can work from. Thank you very much, everyone. I've been speaking to Professor Dato Dr. Adiba Binti Kamarozaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine, University of Malaya, Associate Professor Dr. Roshdi Abdul Rashid, Consultant Psychiatrist, also from UN, of course, Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Center for Health and Social Policy. You've been listening to Health and Living on a Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.